Hi. Thank you guys all for coming on this kind of beautiful but also kind of gray Boston day, kind of typical Boston day. I am so excited to, well, first of all, wait, who am I? You have no idea. You're like, who are you, lady? I'm Joanna Rakoff, and I've been tasked by the festival with the really awkward thing of introducing myself to you. I'm the author of of the memoir, My Salinger Year, which has been published in many, many countries and made into a feature film starring Sigourney Weaver and Margaret Qualley. That is streaming now if you want to see it, and also a novel called A Fortunate Age that won some prizes, and I write for a bunch of magazines. That's me, and I live here in Cambridge, and I'm so excited to be here. I've only ever participated in the Boston Book Festival in the position of the guys, and it's fun to be the moderator. I'm in charge. Okay, power. So, moving on. When the Boston Book Festival asked me to moderate this panel, I was really excited, as you could tell by my extreme excitement. And I felt sort of seen, because this subject is something that's fascinated, or honestly kind of obsessed me since I was a teenager, since before I had children, the intersection of motherhood and ambition, just because of certain experiences I had watching my mother and my much older sister traverse life. But I also felt kind of frustrated by this invitation because the day before it arrived in my inbox, I had made the decision to take a break from events. Some of you might know me from bookstore events. In Boston, I do a lot of them. And I decided to take a break because my latest book is very, 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 very late because over the past few years, I've found myself constantly just pulled under by the tidal wave of motherhood. So there's this kind of irony there, but I, of course, was like, yes, of course, I'll do it, yes. How could I say no? So I say this really just so that you understand that for me, and I think probably for many of you here, the ideas and questions that we'll be looking at today are not abstract. In the way that they sometimes are when we do panels like this. This is not like an abstract talk about art or ideas or philosophy. These are questions that I face every single day in every choice that I make. And before I introduce our authors, I want to cover a couple of things. Like, one is I just want to ask, like, is there anyone here who's gone on a work trip and been asked, like, if you're a female person, been asked, you know, where are your kids? Anyone at all? Just me.
Oh, no, me too. Yeah. No.
Right? That's Isn't that like everyone? Or like or like who's taking care of your kids? Right? Everyone. Yeah. And I mean, have any of you had to make a choice between an important career milestone or personal achievement and going to a school play or any sort of important child anything? Right, okay. So these are, you know, we are going to be talking about questions that are kind of integral to, I hate to speak in like these essentialist terms, but like pretty much almost any woman's life, mothers, daughters. Okay, and a couple more like things before I introduce these amazing people. I just want to mention that we are gathered here at a very dark moment in world history, which if I talk any more about it, I'm going to start to cry. And I suspect, I'm not going to take a poll again, but I suspect many of you are feeling very fragile right now, as some of us on stage are. And I couldn't quite proceed with this panel without acknowledging what is going on. But I'm hoping that like, we're addressing really important questions and ideas here, like important to world humanity. And so I'm hoping that this hour will be a welcome respite from the news and from the horror, and that maybe we'll all leave here feeling a little bit, like I'm just gonna be super cheesy here, a little bit like nourished and restored and excited. So thank you for being here, seriously. One housekeeping thing that I've been asked to mention is just that right immediately following this, downstairs, there will be a signing of books. So if you're interested in that, which you all should be, please just stick around, go downstairs, and these guys will be signing books. Okay, so I am going to introduce these lovely people, and then each of them is going to read a little bit from their books that we're here to discuss, and then we're going to have a discussion, and then you're going to participate in the discussion. So why don't we start with, wait, oh my God, Sadiqa, I'm so scared I'm going to mispronounce your name.
Okay.
Is it Sadiqa?
Qua.
Sadiqa, okay.
Yes.
Thank you. I should have asked this beforehand. What is wrong with me? Okay. Sadiqa Johnson is the author of 5 novels, most recently Yellow Wife, which was a finalist for the Hurston Wright Legacy Award and an NPR Best Book of 2021. And yes.
Thank you.
I don't, no big deal. And the novel we're here to discuss today, Daughters of Eve, which is
The House of Eve.
Oh my God. I'm so sorry.
Okay.
You guys, I just feel like I should explain that this has been a very hard week in my house. My son was evacuated from Israel and whatever. So just forgive me if like I'm not myself.
Mm,
sorry.
That's okay.
House of Eve. Which
we're all in this together. Yeah. We're all right? We're all in this together. Yes.
Yes. Hey. Okay. Very little sleep happening. Which, House of Eve, a selection of Reese's Book Club and an instant New York Times bestseller. Instant New York Times bestseller. Sadiqa teaches at Drexel University's MFA program. And then we have Elizabeth Silver, Liz. Her 3 books have been translated into 7 languages. She is the author of the acclaimed memoir, The Tincture of Time, as well as 2 novels, The Execution of Noah P. Singleton, which was an Amazon Best Book of 2013, and the novel we're here to discuss today, The Majority, which has garnered raves like everywhere, and many people I know have been talking about it a lot, but specifically in the Washington Post and the LA Times. And then, yay! Okay. And then next to me, we have Jean Kwok, who is the author of 4 novels, which have been published in 20 countries, including the instant New York Times bestseller. Another instant New York Times bestseller. How does this happen? That's Searching for Sylvie Lee, and the novel we're here to discuss today, The Leftover Woman, which is a Book of the Month Club pick and an Elle Best Books of 2023 already, even though the year is not over. So she is also a former professional ballroom dancer. I couldn't not say that. Okay. So I'm wondering if you guys want to just read maybe in this order? Does that sound
sure.
okay?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, this order.
What do you think? Or do you want to
start? Do you want
to start? Yeah, do you want to start in this order?
I'm like the only one who doesn't have a book, so I have to read. I have to look on my phone, find a chapter, all of that. So you go, darling.
Okay, so I'm going to read from The Leftover Woman, and just to give you a quick context about what the book is about, it's about 2 mothers, 2 worlds, and 1 impossible choice. So it's about what happens when, in China, a young woman gives birth, and it's told shortly after birth that her baby had died, finds out a few years later that her daughter had not died, but had been placed for adoption by her no good husband, that's my favorite part, by her no good husband to a wealthy American couple. And when the novel begins, Jasmine has followed her daughter to the US to get her back. And the book is told from Jasmine, the birth mother's point of view, and also from the point of view of Rebecca, who is affluent and a publishing executive and has it all, including an adopted Chinese daughter she adores. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to read from the first chapter a scene from Jasmine's point of view. Jasmine has come to the US and owes money to the Chinese mafia because she came, you know, kind of betting everything to try to get her kid back, and she's trying to get work. A small man wearing a wrinkled gray suit, much too big for him, exited the kitchen and approached me. He looked as tired as his faded eyes. "You looking for work? What's your name?" I started to push my glasses up my nose, then realized I'd taken them off. I felt exposed without them, especially with the 2 women watching us. How many times had I already had this conversation? Could I trust him not to report me? I stared at his shoes. I'm a very hard worker. He barked out a laugh. Let me guess. You don't have the right paperwork, and you want me to give you a job, even though you're too scared to even tell me your real name. Forget it. He waved a dismissive hand and turned to leave. I can clean tables, waitress, serve dim sum. I'm dexterous and have a good memory. My heart was racing. I was talking too quickly. I couldn't return to China and my disastrous life there. I closed my eyes. I passed a menu board on the way in. What had it said? Your specials today are braised pork and gravy, shrimp with vermicelli and garlic, and vegetarian crystal dumplings. He paused. Can you come in full time? A few nights a week? He shrugged. I have people lining up to work 24 hours a day, especially if they're in your situation. In my peripheral vision, I noticed both women perk up as a young man stepped past us on his way to the kitchen. He was hunched over, his head averted, as if trying to make himself less conspicuous. He wore a navy jacket with an elaborate emblem on the sleeve. A worn guitar case was slung over his back, an incongruous sight for a person heading into the depths of a restaurant where there were vats of boiling oil and flustered cooks, not to mention live lobsters. The manager spotted him and erupted like a bulldog confronting a Doberman in the street. What do you think this is? A storage area? The beleaguered man took a deep breath but didn't stop. I'm so sorry, I'll stash the guitar, you won't notice. There was something familiar about his warm tenor that called to me. I didn't recognize the voice, rather the inflection of his Chinese, the rhythm of his words. I tended to avoid young men with their grabby hands and clinging eyes, but I was riveted to this one. His hair was dark and silky, the gleam of amber highlights visible even in the fluorescent lighting. Come here. The manager actually stomped his foot. The man slowly turned toward us, and when he caught sight of me, he froze. My heart lurched. I stared into a face that I both knew and didn't know at all. Two thick slashes of eyebrows, dusky skin, a square masculine face with eyes like melted chocolate. Anthony. He was etched into my soul and yet entirely new to me. I remembered gangly shoulders, a broad open grin, his thin fingers plucking on guitar strings while perched on the steps of his house, one of the largest in our village. Then his family moved away and it stood empty, with me staring into the blank windows day after day. How many times had we shared a package of uncooked ramen noodles before he left, sprinkling the seasoning on top so we could munch them like chips? My eyes rested upon the man, but my soul recognized a boy I hadn't seen in 10 years, my best friend when I was 14 years old. He was gaping at me. Then he whispered, "It's you."
All right. Excuse me. So I'm going to read the opening of my new novel, The Majority, which is a fictional memoir of a first female Supreme Court justice in America. And so when I set out to write this book, so much of it, I talked to my publisher, I talked to my agent, is about ambition and motherhood explicitly. So the fact that this is what this panel is about is just very exciting and fulfilling. So I'm just going to read the opening couple of pages. Found in the desk of the late Sylvia Olin Bernstein, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States of America. Half of the United States is waiting for me to die. The other half stands by, candles in hand, praying for me to hang on. At least that's what they tell me. At least that's what they say, but people never really want what they think they want. Every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday from October through April, The main doors of the Supreme Court open at 8. There are only 50 seats available for the general public, and by 9:30 a.m., those eager visitors who waited outside for hours will have secured most of them. Sometimes, when nobody's there, I walk into the main courtroom to sit in the back of the gallery. The perspective is different, almost more ominous. From there, I can see 4 marble columns standing tall before deep mahogany curtains edged in gold. When I was younger, I used to stare at the curtains in pictures and later in person, sometimes wanting to hide in them. Now I know better than to hide. On the days we have argument, a court crier pushes the buzzer, warning the crowd that there are 5 minutes to prepare and take a seat. The 9 of us wait in the robing room backstage where no one can visit, beginning the process of coming out into the courtroom. We have a private pregame ritual, a rotating handshake among all 9 of us as if to say, yes, we are all in this together. Everyone takes part in this tradition, now between 6 men and 3 women who sometimes like each other and sometimes hate each other when the robe is on and tolerate each other when it's off. The court crier opens his mouth. Oye, oye, oye. We walk out of the robing room to take our places behind our specific chairs at the bench. Mine is marked with a tiny gold plaque carved with the initials S-O-B. I take my seat. The Chief Justice glances to either side and picks up his gavel, slamming the wood with a single pound. It pierces the silence as I scan the gallery. My eyes are old, though. They don't always see what's in front of them. My hair has faded from the yellow, stubborn blonde of my youth, and I've lost some of my height, though having started at 5'11", I'm still taller than most of the men who've surrounded me for decades. As arguments open, all eyes are on me, wondering what I'm thinking. But it's my own eyes, still a clear light blue, that are the first to reveal the truth. If you look closely enough, you might have to reconsider everything you know about me, everything you thought you knew about the first female Supreme Court Justice of the United States of America, the Honorable Justice Sylvia Olin Bernstein. The first time I sat in that chair, I felt an unnecessary distance from a breathing life, as if I were meant to be protected by an older code. Outside, people wave signs of praise, of hate, of hope that the contemptuous SOB might make a change. I hated the name. Just call me bitch, I wanted to say. I'm nobody's son. You see, everyone thinks that I broke the rules, but I didn't. Not really. I just oiled them up a bit for everyone else. But biographers want to present me like that. Pretty but rough. Demanding but kind. A model for how to get to the top as a woman and be remembered in history with elegance and idealism. This is the true story, though. I wouldn't be here if I'd had the luck of my cousin Mariana, or if I'd fought the fight like my friend Linda. Still, history chooses whom to crown an iconoclast, whether they deserve it or not. But history is only as good as the historians, and I'm no longer trusting them to tell my story.
So I'm going to read a little bit from my novel, The House of Eve. The story is told from 2 different perspectives. It's Ruby and Eleanor's story. And Ruby is the first in her family. It takes place in the 1950s, hence the historical fiction comment. Ruby is the first in her family to be on track to go to college. But, you know, she doesn't come from a lot. But there is this boy that she meets, an unlikely love. His name is Shimmy. He's white and Jewish, and they live in North Philadelphia. And so I'm going to read a little scene from when they first meet. Sorry about the phone, guys. I mean, you know, the thing is that I'm like the lightest packer ever. So like ever, right? Like I don't ever want to check my bag. So like carrying an actual book is way too much. So I'm just going to pick up from, so the scene starts with Ruby has moved into her aunt's house because her mother doesn't want her. It's a lot of mother and daughter in the story. And so living in her aunt's house is where she paints. And so she calls it her Ruby's Red World. I call it Ruby's Red's World, where I have complete control over everything. Dinah Washington was singing, I Want to Be Loved, when a hard rap against the door smacked me back. Who is it? My voice came out husky. Ms. Marie, it's Shimmy. I wiped my hand on my aprons and swung open the door. A pale boy with curly brown hair stood under the fluorescent hall light. Our eyes touched, and the air around me felt sticky and warm. Who are you? His cheeks flushed beet, and his emerald green eyes stared at me 2 seconds beyond polite. Ruby, Marie's my aunt. Shimmy Shapiro. I stepped aside to let him enter. He smelled like cedar, with a hint of the potatoes I pictured him having for dinner. I felt unkempt in my splashed apron and wish I had left my bangs curled over my wide forehead. His eyes lingered over my canvas and paints, then turned his focus to the kitchen. The sink here? I nodded, and he rolled his shirt sleeves to his elbows and hiked up his dungarees. After placing his tool bag on the table, he got down on the floor. He pushed aside the makeshift curtain that covered the plumbing and pulled out a bucket. I could smell bleach and see a bottle of vinegar and a small flask that probably contained corn liquor. With his head underneath the sink, he called to me, "Can you hand me that flashlight?" I looked down at the stick hanging from the top of his bag and unclipped it. Our fingers brushed against each other as he took it from me. "Are you an artist?" I blew out a nervous giggle. Wouldn't say that. He rooted around and then pulled his head up and sat up. "Is it fixed?" "No, I don't have the right tools." He took off his gloves and wiped the sweat on his forehead. "Can I have a drink of water?" Each cup I picked up was either chipped or faded, and I didn't want to feel shamed in front of this white boy. I chose my tin mug with the dent next to the handle. He leaned against the sink and sipped while taking in my homemade studio in the corner. "You look like an artist to me. What are you painting?" I glanced down at my bare feet. The pink polish had chipped on my big toe, and I covered it with the other foot. "Nothing really, just passing time." "Well, can I see?" Ordinarily, I didn't show anyone besides Aunt Marie my work, but there was something about the way he asked. It had a sweetness to it that blotted away some of the sourness from my awful day. Timidly, I turned the easel his way. He moved in closer to me, then put his hand on his chin and studied it, almost like he was at a museum. "It's beautiful, but moody. What's got you so sad?" He stared at me with intense green eyes. His expression was thoughtful, and I could tell that he was actually interested in what I had to say. "Who says I'm sad? The contrast in colors here and here." "You an art critic or something?" I turned my easel away from him. "No, but I've taken a few classes at the art museum, and I know I like it." I wasn't used to compliments. His appreciation of my work made me feel foolish for turning the easel, so I dropped my hands and allowed him to see it. He took in the painting again. I wrapped my arms around my middle, suddenly feeling exposed. Well, the bird says it all. The tiny bird was the only object on the page that was bright and in full color. "Thank you," I mumbled finally, having not realized that I had been holding my breath this whole time. "May I?" He reached for my paintbrush. I nodded, and then he dipped the brush in my smear of yellow and dagged a streak through the big head's hair. It added the perfect contrast to the blue bird. "If you don't like it, you can cover it with black." No, it's nice. My heart was thumping like I had just taken the stairs two at a time. Shimmy stood so close to me that we were almost touching. The way he stared at my painting made me feel like he was peeking at my soul. He finished his water and then put his cup in the sink. Turning for the door, he said, "I better go. Tell your aunt my mother will send somebody by. Guess I'll see you around, Ruby." "When?" The question escaped from my lips too quick for my brain to stop it, and I wanted to grab the word and shove it back inside. There was no reason for me to see this white boy again, even if he did like my art. "I work at Greenwald's candy store," he offered a boyish grin. "Come by tomorrow for a malt. We'll see." Shimmy hesitated in the hall. if you come, it'll be on me. Thank you.
Okay, I want to kind of start from the beginning. I was thinking about commonalities between these three books, and there is a lot of overlap in terms of theme, but I wanted to start with just plot and character. All three books have some kind of root in real life people and events, and I don't know if you guys could talk a little bit about that in regard to the idea of motherhood and ambition. And Sadiqa, I know you were thinking about your grandmother, is that right? Maybe, could you start, tell us a little bit?
So when I finished Yellow Wife, it was really clear to me that that was the best novel that I had to offer. And it was like, well, how do you better your best, right? And that's a scary thought. And so I started thinking about my own family history. I remember my grandmother telling me that she was the black sheep of our family. She got pregnant with my mom at age 14, and she gave birth to her at 15. This was the 1950s, and she was unmarried. She didn't have a husband in sight. And so there was a lot of shame and secrecy around the birth of my mother, so much so that my mother tells me that she didn't know my grandmother was her mother until she was in the third grade. Hmm. Up until that point, it had never been discussed. And there was always sort of this tension between my mother and my grandmother, and I couldn't really put my finger on it. And it got me to think about mothers and daughters and what choices that women have in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s when they found themselves pregnant and no husband. You know, there was a lot of problems with that. And that thought led me to the discovery of maternity homes. I found that between 1945 and 1975, 1.5 million babies were born in these maternity homes. The women, the girls, were often coerced to give up their babies. And I wondered, how come I didn't know that, right? I feel like with women's history, a lot of our history is sort of shoved to the side or not important. And when I learned that fact, it was like, I need to expose this. And I need to expose it from the perspective of this young black girl who finds herself in trouble, and what options does she have available to her?
Well, Liz, why don't you talk a little bit about how you came to write this novel that is sort of like inspired by the life of Ruth Bader Ginsburg? And you're a lawyer yourself, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so interested in what you were talking about with maternity homes and what you mentioned, which is something that happened to me also, about not knowing something that seems so embedded in history that I feel like I should know. I was embarrassed that I didn't know certain parts of women's history that led me to really explore some of those topics in this book. So yes, the book is loosely inspired by Ruth Bader Ginsburg as well as Sandra Day O'Connor and all sorts of other powerful women. And I remember I live in Los Angeles, and I was in San Diego for an event for my memoir, my last book, and I had a one-year-old and a three-year-old at the time. And I was thinking, wow, like up until that point, I didn't necessarily feel a difference between the men and, or the boys and the girls, the men and the women, in when I was in college, when I was in grad school for creative writing, when I was in law school, in work. It wasn't until I became pregnant with my first child that the world suddenly started looking at me differently, started treating me differently, started asking me questions that I had no idea where they came from, questions that you started this whole panel with about, you know, who's watching your children? There was not a single event I did for my first couple of books that somebody didn't ask that. And then I remembered, you know, I was driving back and I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, do these women like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, women like Sandra Day O'Connor, women like Hillary Clinton, what are they really thinking about? Like, do they come home and feel like frauds like I do? Sometimes, like, you want to put off this kind of idea of, like, with ambition and motherhood. Like, I didn't lose any ambition, but I was shocked that the world was putting that on me. And so I literally pulled over on the side of the road and started kind of thinking of this idea of, you know, well, first of all, I can look to a lawyer because I had gone to law school. I was like, well, first of all, half of it is half the world wanting me not here. And then the other part of it was, what does that look like? I wanted to know more than the biographies that are given out there. I wanted to know more than the biopics that are out there about these powerful women, because I found that these, you know, very powerful women often have, are very loud, or they have, they take up a lot of real estate sometimes. But what about the quiet people? What about the women who are changing the world silently, or maybe in ways that we don't see? And I looked at people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and thought, well, that's somebody who I think is doing that or did that before she had this, you know, moniker of the notorious RBG. And so I was really intrigued by exploring what was maybe left on the cutting room floor of, you know, movies about these women or books about these women and biographies. And I wanted to know about their regrets. I wanted to know about their failures. I wanted to know about their fights with their and their love affairs, you know, and the relationships in their lives. I didn't necessarily want to hear just about the law, although, you know, it is about a woman on her way to the Supreme Court, but I really wanted to know about what got her there, mm-hmm. and the sacrifice and the love and the relationships. And so it really was born from that. And in that sense, you know, I like what you were saying earlier about finding out about maternity homes, I was thinking back to years earlier in law school, and I took this American legal history class, and I had a professor who was saying, well, I couldn't take out a credit card in my own name until 1972. And 1973, we know as Roe v. Wade, you know, that pregnancy discrimination was real until very recently. Mm-hmm. And so I really, you know, wanted to explore pregnancy bias, pregnancy discrimination, as a kind of a side storyline to this very personal story of, you know, friendship and marriage and motherhood.
I was fired from a job when I was 5 months pregnant, so it's like not even,
no.
Yeah, wow. Anyway. A story for another day.
We'll talk.
Jean, you've called The Leftover Woman your most personal novel, even though I know that your previous novels all are sort of rooted in personal history. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you mean by that, with The Leftover Woman and its origins.
Right. I mean, I think what I love about this panel is that it's, you know, and I mean, the books up here are amazing, the writers are amazing, and it's fascinating how we are all coming at these themes from a different angle, right? Illuminating different parts of this issue. The Leftover Woman is, of course, told by two very different women. It's told by Jasmine, the birth mother, and it's told by Rebecca, the affluent adoptive mother. And it's obvious my connection to Jasmine, because I am also Asian. I was very poor growing up, working class, did not speak English. And in my Chinese family, my very traditional Chinese family, I was at rock bottom in the power hierarchy as a woman and as the youngest, you know, of seven children. So I was not allowed to look my brothers or my father in the eye, let alone voice a dissenting opinion. I, you know, like when people would get married, a male relative with seemingly good genes would roll across the marriage bed to increase the likelihood of having sons. And so the book deals with what happens in China during the one-child policy, when the government said suddenly, well, if you have more than one child, we are going to penalize you severely, severely, meaning get rid of your job, year's salary worth of fines, you know, really basically destroy your life if you have more than one child. The result of which is that nowadays in China, there are 32 million more men than women. 32 million when the birth rate is basically 50-50. So we are losing, we have lost 32 million women somewhere, right? Where? And so that, you know, that's what happens in the book. That's, you know, because of the one-child policy, Jasmine's husband places their daughter for adoption without her knowledge. And so I'm obviously very connected to Jasmine and trying to find her way in a world where she is powerless, but I'm also very connected to Rebecca as well, who, like us, is, you know, so many of us, is a career woman. She's trying to juggle all those roles and keep all the balls up in the air. Like, she's got a career, she's got a family, she's got a husband. She is judged so harshly by everyone around her, and she judges herself so harshly. And I remember when I was, when my kids were little, and I was on the airplane with my husband, and my husband changed the baby's diaper. And to hear the flight attendants, it was like the Messiah had come. You know, I mean, it was like, oh, what a clever, lovely man who can change the baby's diaper. And I'm just like, you know, I have changed a diaper too in my life. You know, and they basically all got together in a chorus and said, nobody cares. Like, they sang out, nobody cares. And that is the difference between being a man and a woman. And obviously, not all the time, not all men, but there is a real kind of societal pressure. And so it was fun. I mean, I really wanted this to be a book about unity, about how much these two moms have in common, more than what divides them. But of course, they are on a collision course. And it was really a pleasure to kind of look at this issue from a lot of different angles. Mm.
Right, so you brought up, you're the first person to sort of introduce the word class, which was actually my next question. It's not a coincidence that all three of these novels feature heroines who are not super privileged, mm-hmm. and who are attempting to kind of vault their way into not just a different economic stratosphere, but into a different kind of, I want to say, like, almost like cultural and political and scientific significance. Like, they want to lead lives of significance. It's hugely important to them. Even Jasmine, I would say, like, even though her goal is more sort of personal, getting her child back. So I wonder if you guys could, anyone wants to talk a little bit about class and the way it works in a book. I'm getting a warning that we have 3 minutes until we go to audience questions.
Oh, wow. Okay. So. Okay.
All right. Be like a Gilmore Girl, sure. Talk fast.
Okay, I'll go fast. So Sylvia is, she's Jewish, she's born in Brooklyn, she has a family of Holocaust survivors. And so she does not come from money, she does not come from anything, and she has very much the book is set in like the 40s, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. And in 1949, this Holocaust surviving cousin of hers comes to live with them, and they have to share a room because there's like one bedroom in their house. This woman very much defines and puts her on a very different trajectory and makes her realize like what happened there cannot happen here. And she sees Sylvia's brain work in a certain way that she thinks, okay, this is somebody who can work the system, who can understand the law, and puts this incredible amount of pressure on her that she takes on. And so she kind of goes from, obviously, you know, being a Jewish woman or young girl in Brooklyn, in this family of Holocaust survivors who had nothing, to have that be kind of the impetus for her to really want to change the way society works in many ways because mm-hmm. of that.
Yeah.
That's my 2 seconds.
When I was researching for The House of Eve, I discovered a book called Our Kind of People by Lawrence Otis Graham. And in the book, he talks about Black families that can establish and trace their roots back 2 and 3 generations of doctors and lawyers and entrepreneurs and extreme wealth, which is not something that we get to see, right? We don't see that often. And so when I found out that little bit, when I was trying to figure out how to make this story work, you know, my second character is Eleanor, and Eleanor finds herself at Howard University. Howard University is one of the HBCUs that have graduated out the most Black doctors in the whole country. And so I thought if she needed to connect with wealth, that would be it. But what I found was that her being just sort of a person from Ohio with no ties to money or influence, there was really no way into this society for her. They really didn't want to have anything to do with her. And so I got to play with class and colorism and education and all of those different isms in the House of Eve.
And I mean, I love what Joanna was saying about class and how it affects our characters, mm-hmm. because Jasmine obviously is poor and it's trying to lead a life of significance and to do something important, as does Rebecca. And Rebecca is a Harvard grad, you know, she seems to be established, and you know, that her husband and her, their friends call them beauty and the brains, with him being the beauty part, and she's the brains part. And I kind of love that about her and her character, but this struggle is real, you know, no matter what class you may be in or trying to achieve, that a woman who's trying to do something of significance, mm-hmm. we are going to often have much less support than others in the world, and you need to be very strong in order to do what you wanted to do.
Yeah. We're gonna start questions. So I'm gonna direct you guys to come up to the microphone rather than asking from your seat, which is in the center of the aisle. And as you guys make your way up there, I am going to just kind of like wrap things up about what we were just talking about in a tiny way, which is everything that you guys are saying reminds me of one of my favorite pieces of coverage of House of Eve. Oh my God, what is wrong with me? You guys, I am so sorry. I have not slept in so long. Was the scholar Carol V. Bell reviewed it for the Washington Post, and she said something that I thought was so perceptive about the book, but that I thought really spoke to our whole discussion, and so I'm just gonna read this brief quote. She wrote, "Ruby and Eleanor want love and careers, family, friendship, security, belonging, respect, and to make a meaningful difference. Were there stories unfolding in the wake of the women's movement, observers might derisively label the scope of their desires as wanting to have it all, but Johnson reveals her characters' wants as instinctual and elemental." And I love this, and this is sort of what I'm saying in closing to my thoughts, because what she's getting at is that in all three of your books, and this is one of the sort of big overlaps I saw, there's almost a kind of radical approach to the idea of ambition. Yeah. Like, I think that we are socialized to think that ambition is in opposition to, like, what I'm going to put air quotes around it, scare quotes around it, like maternal instinct, and that these two things are at odds with each other. And what she's saying is happening, and has to be, and I think is happening in your books too, is that you're constructing ambition as much an intrinsic part of the self and the psyche as any sort of like supposed maternal instinct. And to me, that's kind of a radical paradigm shift. Mm-hmm. And I hope that maybe it's gonna change the world. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm done. Go ahead. And maybe introduce yourself, please.
Hi, I'm Bridget. Thank you all for being here. I'm really interested in the concept of intersectionality. And when thinking about motherhood or especially, you know, I think a lot of times when we talk about women, we're thinking like women versus men. But I think it's a really interesting concept of like the different lives that women innately have from their family or just cultural background. So I'm wondering if you can talk maybe a little bit about that when you're conceptualizing a character of, you know, everything that goes into not just woman versus man, but this particular woman.
I think one of the themes of The Leftover Women is the ways in which we have to compartmentalize ourselves. And everyone has to do that, but I do feel like women and immigrants, we often, you know, we're a mom, we are a we're a friend, we are a partner, we are a business person in our work lives, and you kind of have to slice yourself into different pieces that are palatable to whichever segment of the population that you are serving yourself to. And The Leftover Woman, is the title is exactly a reference to that, to the fact that, well, Rebecca has to do it, but Jasmine too, that in the end, who we are is what everyone has carved away from us, and we are what is left. And it is a difficult thing because in a lot of ways, you feel like you're so many different people in one, and how do you unify yourself and move through the world as a unified, harmonic whole?
For me, I would say, I'm gonna just change the question just a little bit and think of it in terms of mothers and daughters, because I feel like this is my fifth novel, and it didn't hit me into this novel that most of my work is exploring my relationship with my own mother, right? And so trying to get to the meaning, trying to get to the basis of it, trying to understand it, which then goes back to my mother and my grandmother's relationship, right? So there's this sort of thing there that I'm trying to figure out. But one of the things that I learned in talking about the House of Eve, because there's a lot of different mothers, there's different types of mothers in the story. But all of the mothers in the story, even if you like them or don't like them or agree or don't agree, in the moment, they're doing what they think is best for their child, right? And so what I have learned is that, like, in that moment, we are always doing what we think is best. Now, in hindsight, I'll turn around and be like, you know what? If I had done this differently, then it could have turned out that way. But in the moment, we're all only doing our very best. And I think that that's important to know, that we have to sometimes just kind of let ourselves off the hook for that reason, is that we are all doing our best.
I love that. Yeah, and I think that in the majority, we have a few different kind of types of women, in the sense that we have Sylvia, who some might see as a bit ambivalent about motherhood, and you have Mariana, who our cousin, who wanted to have children, but she was never able to. And you have Linda, her best friend, who did not want to have children. And I think that it's really important to give real estate and way to all women, regardless of their choice, because each of those choices or each of those experiences is important. And you know, and it kind of goes to, in a sense, you know, when you work together, the women are the majority. And so the title is taken from the fact that a majority opinion in law becomes the law, and that's the decision that ends up becoming the law for everybody. But also, women are the majority in population, but the minority in power. Mm. And what does that mean? I want to, and especially when you're looking at choices of motherhood, not just whether or not you are a mother.
You guys, I want to take 1 second and just kind of synthesize a few things you guys are saying, which I hope is okay with everyone. Which is, Sadiqa, what you were talking about in terms of mothers and daughters, to me, makes me think so much, and like sort of everyone trying to do their best in that moment, which I think we all really are. But just to like quote from another review, a critic I love, Beth Ann Patrick, reviewed The Majority for the LA Times, and she said something that really stuck out to me thinking about all of your books, which is with regard to Sylvie. She says, "What matters most, the work Sylvie does for women's rights or her relationship with her daughter?" And I feel like that's actually a question that, even though, you know, every woman, every mother in these books they're trying to do their best, and they're making choices in a moment-to-moment way, there are these kind of larger questions, like thinking about Ruby, like, is it the best thing for her that her daughter goes, you know, like that she gives up her daughter and she pursues the career that she wants, which is crucial to her as a human being, you know, like what? So I think it's just a huge part of this question of motherhood and ambition that you're constantly having to kind of calibrate, you know, do I make a choice to sort of like, I don't know, to go to that march, to stay at work 2 extra hours, or do, you know, what is the best thing for my child and for me? So anyway, go ahead.
So I have 2 questions. I had my one question ready, but then you guys shocked me, so now I have a second question. So my first question is first for Jean. Your book, which is brilliant, by the way, and I absolutely loved it, is, you say, always say, 2 women, 2 mothers, 1 impossible choice. So you have an adoptive mother, a birth mother, 1 baby. Can't have, one mother's gonna end up with the baby. So I was wondering, did you ever consider an alternate ending than the one that you provided, and I'd love to hear from the other 2 authors as well. Mm.
Yes, I did, and indeed, the novel is an impossible dilemma, And I wasn't going to cop out and have them both get the kid. So there is a clear choice at the end. And it was so hard to find the right balance. And I had an early reader say, well, maybe we, I think you should make Rebecca into the villain and basically have Jasmine, you know, be the heroine, and she's fighting against Rebecca, and in the end, she can win or lose. And I said, I don't want to do that, because actually I love Rebecca, and I love both of these women, and I believe that in an adoptive, interracial adoptive situation, there is no one answer, that you cannot say the child always belongs with the birth mother or always belongs with the adoptive mother. It depends so much on that individual situation. So I wrote a book where both mothers have equal weight and both are making horrible choices, but also deeply, deeply good choices where they absolutely love their daughter. And in the end, it has to work out. So at some point in this book, everybody was like in jail, in bed with each other, or dead. So it was like, I mean, really, like there were so many variations of what happened. But in the end, it seems like people are happy with the ending I came up with. And I hope you will be as well.
Aww. This book, it's more about, so you know from like basically page one that she's going to wind up with the Supreme Court, so there wasn't really an alternative to that not happening, but it was more along the lines of how did she get there? Right. And that's what changed in so many shapes and forms. I mean, the book is set primarily, you know, in these four different time periods, so it's technically historical. There were, at one point, there was like 10 different time periods or 12 different time periods, and that just didn't work. I wasn't getting connected or deep into the character for any of those moments, so I really decided to really slow things down, focus on four specific moments in time that really reflect who she is and where we are as a society at that point, to show the trajectory up until her appointment with a frame of, you know, this older woman looking back. Mm.
And yeah, there's a baby at the center of my book too. I think Gina and I should just be on the road all the time. But there is a baby at the center of my book as well. And I did kind of play as I was moving towards the end of the book, like who's gonna have the baby, who's not gonna have the baby. But one of the quotes, my favorite quote in my book is, and I won't tell you which character it is, because there's Ruby and Eleanor, but I don't wanna spoil it for you. But one of my characters says, I could be unhappy, but I couldn't be poor. And so she had to make a choice.
The second question, which I've just learned in this panel, is, Jean, you shocked me to learn there are 32 million more men than women in China. And Sadiqa, I was shocked that 1.5 million children born into these maternity homes that I did not know about between 1945 and 1975. So my question is, were those the most shocking things that you learned while researching your book? And if they weren't, what was?
Wait, Jean, before you answer, I just want to make sure everyone knows we have about 5 minutes. So if anyone else has a question, maybe kind of approach the microphone so we know you're waiting. That would be amazing.
What
was the question?
The most shocking thing in the book was actually, for me, was how women used to test to find out if they were pregnant. There's this whole section in the book. I had to research it. I will just say that it deals with urine and a frog, and you'll have to read the book to figure it out.
I think the most shocking thing that I found out was that in the one-child policy, of course, women had no power. And now with 32 million, you know, deficiency, you would think that the women have all the power in China. And that is absolutely not true. Not true. And they are still suffering, and still the propaganda campaign is called the leftover woman in China, shaming women who are 26 and older, who are not married, because the birth rate has declined to such an extent that they are panicked, but yet it's still the woman's fault.
Mm. Yeah. I think that it's just, you know, it's along the same lines of all of the laws that we have in terms of, you know, what was legal and what was not legal and what women are allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do in terms of holding a bank account in your own name, which you could not do into the 70s, pregnancy discrimination being legal up and through almost until the early 90s, and many, many other cases like this in which things are not that different. We still don't have parental leave, right? We still don't have paid parental leave. And so there is not much that's really changed, and things are changing in so many different ways. And so it's when you do a deep dive into our system, you see how few rights, you know, are given.
Hi, thank you so much for this. Has just been so empowering. When I heard about the Boston Book Festival and this panel in particular, I just knew that I was like putting a Sharpie through my calendar as a mom, and I am off limits all day, right? And yet I knew my daughter was going to see the Taylor Swift movie and going to get dolled up. And I say this because I received a text just about an hour ago, and she's getting ready to go out, and my husband doesn't know how to use a curling iron. And it was a moment for me where I felt like I had to make a decision. Like, no, Jean, don't be hard on yourself. Like, this is very important. And I'm wondering, for each of you, when it comes to your writing, how do you set those boundaries when you're a writer and a mother?
That's such a good question. Thank you for that. So I was just at the Virginia Creative Center of the Arts. I had a two-week writer's residency that you have to apply for. They pick your dates months in advance, and so your date is your date. So you go, you write, they feed you, and it fell on, my daughter is a freshman in college, and it fell on her fall break. And so I hadn't seen her since August, and she first wasn't coming home for fall break, so it was fine. And then it was, no, I'm coming home for fall break. And then it was the decision of, do I leave the residency to go see my daughter, who I had not seen since August, or do I stay here and do what I said I was going to do? And I stayed. And I finished writing, and then I didn't get to see her. But it was crushing for me. But I did it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God, I relate to that so much. Oh, and I feel like everybody in this room probably relates to that in some capacity. And I feel like my kids are much younger. I have a 7 and a 9-year-old. And so I feel like every single day there's this question. Like, so I was leaving to come here. I'm going away for a week. I'm going to be gone for a week. And it's not the first time I've done this. You know, we've gone on book tours. We've gone to residencies. But it's always a question. And I was just telling Joanna this on the walk over here. They've known that I'm going to be leaving for a week for weeks now. And as, you know, as I was about to leave for the airport, I had a red eye. I live in Los Angeles. I had a red eye to come here. I said, you know, bye, I love you. And we hugged each other, and they started crying. They're like, you're leaving? I thought you said you're just going for one night. And I said, no, honey, we've been talking about this. I'm going for a week. And they were just hugging me and crying, and then, but I left. And I know that they're fine. You know, I think that, you know, there's that sense of you know, we'll miss each other. I think there's also that sense of performance when I'm leaving out the door. Mm-hmm. And then, because I will always get, you know, whether it's whoever's with them whenever I leave for anything, work-related or not work-related, socially, mm-hmm. Going out with friends or anything, you know, there's a 5 minutes later, oh, she's fine, he's mm-hmm. fine, they're
yeah.
fine.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to go there. I mean, I think that I feel the guilt, absolutely. I have kids, and I have killed myself trying to juggle both and to do, and like lost sleep and done everything, but I'm gonna say it. I am little and cute, but I think I'm really smart. And I think that I have something to contribute to the world that is important. And thank you, thank you. I think we all do. And I love my children. I will do, of course, whatever I need to for them, but I also have a mind and a soul that contributes to our world. Mm. And I think I have a right to have that, and I have a right to use it. And I think that as women, it's so easy to put ourselves absolutely last all the time. Mm. And I've done it. I mean, I have killed myself, but I have seen the smartest, most brilliant women give up their minds, give up their souls, because they're moms, and society is saying to us, you know, motherhood comes first. Well, you know, does it really? I mean, yes, okay, yes, we love our children, but I am so much more than just a mother. I was born with the talent that I was born with, and I am going to own that, and I think I have a right to use it and to give back to the world as best as I can.
Mm, love that. Mm-hmm.
That's an amazing note to end on. Yeah. Thank you guys so much for being here. And please go downstairs and let these guys sign books for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.